All right, we're back, and this is our second lecture on Kant. So far, what we've learned is that Kant believes the principles of morality will follow if it happens to be the case that human beings have freedom. And the type of freedom, or what Kant means by freedom, it was claimed, is a some form of rationality, both in the theoretical sphere and in the practical sphere. So what Kant has in mind is that for both the theoretical and practical domains, in order to be free, human beings have to possess the capacity to think critically about their beliefs and desires, but more than that, to also have the capacity to modify their beliefs and desires if both their desires and beliefs fail to meet the standards of rationality. And that capacity, right, the capacity to modify our desires and beliefs is really what Kant has in mind, right? It's the capacity to change ourselves, right? To change my motivations, to change my beliefs. And that's a big deal for Kant. And a lot actually turns in his argument for, for morality, or on the, for the sake of morality. A lot actually turns on whether or not Kant is right about freedom. And so we'll need to think about that as time goes on. And we'll return to the question later, by the end of our lectures on Kant, we'll return to the question about whether or not human beings actually are free in the sense that Kant stipulates. So this is a big deal. And in fact, it's something that is still being hotly debated in philosophy today. Many of the questions that we've explored over the semester, I wouldn't say that anyone's reached a consensus, but certainly there's sort of an orthodoxy or an orthodox position that's developed, and many of the issues that we've discussed have been settled as far as philosophers are concerned. But the issue that Kant is touching upon now, and that David Hume also touches upon, those questions are still up for grabs. The jury's still out on those questions. And the question, of course, is, are human beings free in the sense that Kant has stipulated? Which was really a question about practical reason. What are the parameters, the limitations of practical reason? Nobody has disputed, or at least very few, I can't think of anyone, who's disputed anything that Kant has said about the theoretical domain, or at least the extent to which human beings are free in the theoretical domain, right? And it just seems obvious that human beings have the capacity to think critically about what they believe, and to also, modify their beliefs if their beliefs fail to hold up to the standards by which we determine whether our beliefs are true or false or contradictory. So nobody has disputed anything that Kant said about that. However, many philosophers have thought that what Kant has to say about reason in its practical deployment doesn't follow. David Hume is probably, the source of much of that criticism, although Hume lived before Kant. So Hume was never responding directly to what Kant had to say, although, if it were possible and we had Kant and Hume in the same room, what would that mean? Hume would have some things to say about how Kant has developed his moral philosophy, and of course they would not have agreed as to the extent and powers that are available to human beings in the practical sphere. So the practical sphere just has to do with conduct and motivation and plans and goals and intentions, right? And what we're concerned with at the present is whether or not Kant was right about reason having full sway in the practical domain. In other words, can I be reasonable about what I desire? As Hume says, is reason a slave to the passions? If Hume was right and reason is a slave to the passions, then much of what Kant has to say, in fact, almost all of what Kant has to say about morality will simply not follow, right? Kant's philosophy, his moral philosophy, is doomed if Hume happens to be right about the nature of practical reason. So I want to set that question aside for now. It's a big question, a question that I don't want to explore right now. because ultimately I want to see what Kant can do if he happens to be right. So imagine that Kant is right about the nature of practical reason, right? The human beings do possess the capacity to think critically about their desires and to modify their desires if their desires fail to meet whatever standards are appropriate. If Kant happens to be right, what can he develop? What sort of things does he believe will emerge from freedom, in other words? Okay. Well, I've already told you that Kant believes autonomy is really where things are at, right? The problem with moral philosophy up until Kant's time is that it had proceeded in a way that he called heteronomy, right, which means a law that comes out from outside, right? So in other words, the moral law is being imposed from outside of the self. And Kant thinks that this is the wrong way to go about doing moral philosophy. And this is why the utilitarians have led us to where they have. So Kant wants to respond to that problem, although, again, we're proceeding in this course sort of ahistorically. We began with Mill, who is the youngest of the philosophers that we will consider this semester. Kant lived before Mill, and Hume lived before Kant. Like I say, we're exploring these questions in a fashion that is ahistorical. But again, philosophers will often put these different historical figures in the same room just to see, what, as a kind of thought experiment, what might happen if Mill and Kant had been able to speak to one another. What might happen had Kant and Hume been able to speak together. So, Kant believes in autonomy, and he thinks that moral philosophy should be about autonomy, right? About the moral law that is found within us, right? And it proceeds from our ability to think critically about our desires and to modify our desires. And what we want to ask is, well, what would motivate us to want to change our desires? Well, Kant's answer is many things, of course, but what ought to motivate us is the moral law, right? Or a love for the moral law. And so, as human beings, we often desire things that may not be good for us, right? It might be imprudent to proceed upon a particular desire. But it's at least some of the time, it will be not only imprudent to proceed upon some desire, it may be entirely immoral to do so, right? So, if I had a desire to take, $100 from my mother's purse, the question is reason capable of blocking that desire? Is reason capable of making it such that I no longer have the desire to take $100 from my mother's purse? So, this is a big question, in moral philosophy, as I've suggested already. Look, if Kant is right about human beings, he believes that something very interesting will emerge from freedom, or from autonomy, right? And we can use these terms interchangeably. Something very interesting will proceed from autonomy or freedom, and he calls it the categorical imperative. Now, the categorical imperative is a very important piece of Kant's overall apparatus, right? His moral apparatus, or his moral system, or we could just say moral philosophy, right? Very important piece. It's Kant's basic rule of morality from which he will derive all of common sense morality. Okay, so let me say that one more time. The categorical imperative will emerge from freedom, if indeed we have freedom. So in other words, if Kant is right about what he's claimed about free will, then he believes that the categorical imperative will emerge from freedom, and from the categorical imperative, he will be able to derive all of common sense morality. So we can see already that the Kant hangs a lot on the on this question of whether or not human beings are free, because ultimately that question will undergird just about everything that Kant has to say about the nature of morality. Okay, so let's say more about the categorical imperative for just a moment, and I want to contrast the categorical imperative with what Kant calls hypothetical imperatives, right? So Kant begins by saying that there are categorical imperatives and there are hypothetical imperatives. Now, categorical imperatives are imperatives that meet all of the time, meaning they're obligatory, right? We think of them as obligations, right? And it doesn't matter whether or not we wish to fulfill our obligations, they're still our obligations no matter how we feel about them, right? In other words, you can't get out of an obligation, you can't get out of a categorical imperative just because you don't want to fulfill it. By contrast, a hypothetical imperative is an imperative that, you know, doesn't meet all of the time, meaning it's not obligatory. It may be prudent to proceed upon a hypothetical imperative, right? You know, if I want to have a good reputation, I should tell the truth, right? And so if I think about lying in that way, then I will think about lying or telling the truth as a hypothetical imperative, but not a categorical imperative. As it stands, Kant thinks about lying and telling the truth as being categorically binding, right? Meaning that it's an obligation that meets all of the time. And you read an article not too long ago about you know, whether or not lying is ever morally permissible, and of course you know how Kant comes down on that issue. But I will say this, just because Kant believes lying is never morally permissible doesn't necessarily entail that he's right about that, right? It doesn't even necessarily entail that his moral philosophy would sustain such a conclusion. In other words, it's possible for Kant to have misinterpreted the implications of his own theory. So keep that in mind as we go forward, and keep that in mind especially as you prepare to write the term paper if you're thinking about writing on Kant. Just because Kant wrote a paper saying that it's never morally permissible to lie doesn't mean that that's true. Although, you know, certainly we should consider the arguments he provides for that conclusion. All right, so we have a distinction between categorical and imperative, categorical and hypothetical imperatives. Let me say just a little more about that before we go on. We might say that hypothetical imperatives are prudential imperatives, meaning that they are binding only when I wish to proceed in some way, or in other words, only when I want something else, right? And so I fulfill the imperative with something else in mind. So let me just read a passage from the groundwork to help you, or to hear at least what Kant has to say about this question. So here he says, let's see here. Oh yes, this relation, he says, whether based on inclination or on rational ideas, can give rise only to hypothetical imperatives. Right? And then he gives an example. I ought to do something because I will something else. As against this, the moral and therefore categorical imperative says, by contrast, I ought to will thus and thus, although I have not willed something else, right? So the distinction that Kant provides is when I'm fulfilling an imperative, or if you're uncomfortable with the word imperative, what he really means is a command, right? A command of reason. If I fulfill the command of reason because I want something else, right? I'm interested in something else other than keeping the command, then he would say that that is a hypothetical imperative. Whereas if there isn't anything else that I want, I'm simply meeting or fulfilling the imperative for the sake of fulfilling the imperative, he wants to call that a categorical imperative, right? And really what he has in mind is a distinction between obligation and prudential imperatives, right? Obligatory and prudential imperatives. And he wants to say again that imperatives that are obligatory are categorical, and what they depend on is nothing other than my desire to meet those obligations, while hypothetical imperatives, on the other hand, depend upon my desire for something else, right? And so they're matters of prudence, right? If I want this, then I should do that. But categorical imperatives, again, are not that way. Doesn't matter what I want, I have to meet my obligations if I'm going to live a moral life. Right? And that's the main distinction between what he calls categorical and hypothetical imperatives. Okay, so back to the categorical imperative now, considering it away from what we've called hypothetical imperatives. Kant distinguishes between three different formulations of the categorical imperative. Right? He names these formulations in the following way. He says that the formula of universal law is the first formulation, and really it may be, in fact Kant does say this, he says that the formula of universal law is the categorical imperative, suggesting that it's probably the best formulation or the most the best way of capturing the claims of the categorical imperative, right? So the formula of universal law is the first. The second is called the formula of humanity, and the third is called the formula of the kingdom of ends. Ends being spelled E-N-D-S, right? The kingdom of ends. Principally, we'll be concerned with both the formula of universal law and the formula of the of humanity. I'll say just a little bit about the formula of the kingdom of ends, but it won't occupy much of our attention. At any rate, so what is the formula of universal law? Well, to help you understand what he has to say here, I'm going to ask you to imagine, a regular morning for yourself. Imagine, you're getting out of bed and you go to the bathroom, take a shower, maybe have some breakfast, then you brush your teeth and you get ready for school or work or whatever it is that you're doing that particular morning. You get dressed and then you make your way about the day. What is unusual in a case like this is for anyone to actually stop and think about what they're doing, right? You're sort of on automatic pilot when you're brushing your teeth, for example, or when you're eating breakfast, or when you're taking a shower. Very few people, or in very few instances, do we find ourselves actually reflecting on, why we brush our teeth, or why I might comb my hair, or whatever it is that I'm doing. Right? Or while I'm driving to work, I don't think about why I'm using my car to drive to work. These are things that are just done without a lot of reflection. However, if someone were to ask me, in the morning, why is it that you're brushing your teeth? Right? Imagine an alien was visiting my home and was wondering, what is this thing that you're doing with that instrument? I could provide a reason, right? I'm brushing my teeth because, I want to have good dental hygiene, and I also don't want to knock anyone over with my breath. Something like that, right? All of these various activities that I perform throughout the day, we want to say, or Kant wants to say, have reasons, right? There are reasons that I perform these actions, although, even though there are reasons for performing these actions, I rarely reflect upon them. However, if asked to provide a reason for why it is that I'm brushing my teeth, or why it is that I'm eating breakfast in the morning, I can provide those reasons rather quickly. And so what Kant wants to say is that all free actions have reasons, right? All free actions have reasons. By contrast, actions that are not free don't have reasons for performing them, right? Imagine that this the same alien witnessed me sneezing or something like that, or witnessed me, or my eye twitching, right? If my eye were twitching or I sneezed, and he said, why did you do that? Well, there would be no reason for why I sneezed, right? Of course, there may be some kind of physiological reason for why I sneezed, but it won't be a reason that is mine, right? It's just something my body sort of did on its own. The same with a twitch in my eye. Right? I may have a slight muscle spasm in my eye, which sometimes happens. And in a way that's similar, of course, we could provide some kind of physiological reason for why I have an eye twitch, but those reasons, again, won't be mine. And what Kant wants to say is that those types of actions are performed involuntarily, and as such, they are not free actions, right? They don't come under the purview of the formula of universal law. Only actions that are performed with reasons come under the purview of the formula of universal law. So remember, the formula of universal law is a formulation of the categorical imperative, right? And as I said earlier, there are two other formulations of the categorical imperative, and I identified those as the formula of humanity and the formula of the kingdom of ends. Now, so what are these different formulations? Well, basically, all of them are just tests by which I determine whether or not the reasons I have for doing what I want to do are valid reasons. Okay? So again, one more time. The formulations of the categorical imperative, and right now we're talking about the formula of universal law. Right? The formula of universal law is simply a test by which I determine whether the reasons I have for performing any given action are valid reasons. Okay? It helps me to determine whether or not I should proceed upon a particular desire to perform some action. Right? Whether or not the motivations I have for performing some action are valid motivations. Right? So I'm going to use the words reason, right? The reason I have for performing an action, or the motivation I have for performing some action, or the principle of action, the principle behind the reason I want, or the principle behind the action, right? Kant sometimes uses that phrase, the principle of action, and all he means is the motivation, right? Whatever is motivating you to do whatever it is that you want to do. He will also use the term maxim. Now, he doesn't mean the magazine. He means again a principle of action, or the subjective principle of action. If you're reading Kant right now, you know that he uses these terms, and sometimes you won't know what he means. But just keep in mind that whenever he says the principle of action, or the motivation, or the reason, right, or the rational principle or rational idea, these terms are being used interchangeably. And he uses maxim in the same way. So a maxim is a subjective principle. It's the reason I have for doing what I want to do, right? And nothing more. Right? A maxim is simply the reason I have for doing what I want to do. And sometimes it's expressed this way. It's a first person statement of intention. Right? What is first person? Well, it's whenever I use an I in a sentence, right? I want to do the following, right? That would be a first-person statement of intention. I want to have lunch at Angelina's because I like Italian food and because I'm hungry and I have enough money to go there. Right? That would be a maxim. And what the formula of universal law asks is, can I make that into a universal law of morality? And that's basically how I determine whether or not the principle of action is a valid principle of action. Okay? Whether or not it can be universalized. So let's read a passage from Kant's Groundwork, just to get a little better sense for what the formula of universal law is. And these are his words. It'll just take me a moment to flip to it. Okay. So he has this to say about the formula of universal law, right? He says, there is therefore a single, or only a single, categorical imperative, and it is this, right? Act only on that maxim, again, act only on that reason, we could say, right? Through which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law, right? Now I know that's a little convoluted, and I'll break it down for you, right? What Kant is basically saying is, act only on those reasons, or act only on those maxims, that you can will as universal laws of morality. Right? So what exactly does that mean? What does it mean to act only on those maxims that you can will as universal laws? Well, basically, Kant has this in mind. Whenever I am motivated to act in some way, I ought to ask whether or not my motivations could become universally binding. What if everyone were to act in the way that I want to act with the reasons I have? What would happen? What would the world look like under those circumstances? In other words, my example from a little earlier, right? I wanted to steal money from my mother's purse, so I know my mother has $100 in there and I'm going to take it. So imagine, right? I start to think, and Kant asks me to consider whether or not my motivations, right, could become universal laws of morality. So what do I ask myself when I'm about to steal from my mother? Well, I want to ask, should everyone steal from their mother with the motivations that they have, that I have? Right? So imagine I wanted to steal $100 from my mother so I could go out drinking with my friends. So there I am, right? And I start thinking, should everyone steal from their mother so they can go out drinking with their friends? And it seems very clear that if everyone were to do such a thing, that it wouldn't be good, right? And this is what Kant has in mind, right? He wants to know whether your principle, right, the subjective principle underlying your action, right? In other words, the motivation you have for performing whatever action you want to perform. He wants to know whether that can become a universal law, or in other words, a universal motivation. Should everyone act in the way that I want to act with the reasons that I have? And Kant thinks if we do this properly, we'll be able to determine what types of actions will satisfy the formula of universal law, and what types of actions won't satisfy the formula of universal law. And what we want to say is that if the reasons I have for performing a particular action are invalid, then I ought not to perform them, right? I ought not to proceed upon maxims that are immoral, right? In other words, I ought not to act on any maxim that doesn't satisfy the formula of universal law, okay? In other words, I know I keep saying in other words, but I want to help you understand. What we want to say is that I ought not to act on any maxim that cannot become a universal law, right? A law that everyone could proceed upon. All right, so that's sort of what Kant has in mind. Only act on maxims or principles that can become universal laws. Okay. So let's see. Well, once we have the formula of universal law, what do we get? Well, if we take for granted the fact that the formula of universal law will emerge with the categorical imperative from freedom, Kant believes he can derive all of common sense morality, right? So everything will follow, right? So that in any situation I might be confronted with, I can always ask myself, can my maxim become a universal law? No matter what situation I'm in, I can always ask that, right? And what Kant wants to say is that if your motivation cannot become a universal law of nature, you ought not to proceed. You ought not to perform the action that is being motivated in the way that you're being motivated, right? And so he thinks he can get just about all of morality, right? Or not just about all morality, but he can get all morality, right? All right. So if I'm autonomous, the argument works, right? And this is why Kant calls it a categorical imperative, meaning that it's binding upon all rational creatures. And that's really what Kant is after, right? He doesn't care about creatures that are irrational, like, you know, Oscar, my dog. He cares about rational beings, right? Because it's only rational beings that are capable of morality, right? No being that is incapable of rationality can be moral. In other words, they don't think of themselves as having obligations, right? Dogs and cats and pigs and cows don't think of themselves as having moral obligations. They probably don't even think of themselves as having hypothetical obligations, right? Okay, so where does that leave us? Well, we have a sense then for Kant's first formulation, the formula of universal law, and what he says is that I should act only on those maxims that can be willed as universal laws of morality. Okay. Let's see. Here are a couple questions for you then. What we want to determine is whether or not I can act upon all maxims that pass the formula of universal law, right? Well, actually, no, that's a question for a little bit later. Okay, I know what I'll do. What we want to determine then is just what is the feature that will help us to identify whether or not we can proceed upon our maxim, right? And essentially Kant has this in mind. Whenever I find myself trying to make an exception of myself, right, an exception to the rule, that is, generally speaking, a telltale sign of immorality for Kant. Right? Let me repeat that. Whenever I find myself trying to make an exception of my situation, right, a situation where I want everyone else to obey by the or abide by the rules while I take advantage of breaking them, that for Kant is a telltale sign of immorality. So what will that look like? Well, essentially Kant says, look, that he says that all immoral behavior will take the form of cheating. Right? What does he mean by that? Well, here we want to imagine what it might be like if everyone were to tell lies, right? Now imagine a world in which everyone were lying all of the time. Now, and as you're imagining the world in which everyone were lying all of the time, you also want to ask yourself this second question. What is it that you want when you do tell a lie? Well, Kant seems to believe this, that whenever we tell a lie, we want some advantage, right? We're trying to get out of a tight spot, or we're embarrassed about how we've behaved, and so we lie in order to get out of being embarrassed, right? Or, you know, we lie in order to preserve our reputation, whatever the reason might be, but we're trying to make an exception of ourselves, right? Here's another question. How is it possible to get away with lying at all in the world, right? What, in other words, what has to be the case in order to get away with lying? And Kant's answer to this question is, in order to get away with lying, it must be presupposed that, generally speaking, human beings tell the truth, right? In a world where everyone lies, right, returning to the first thought experiment, imagine a world in which everyone lies, there would be no incentive to tell a lie, right? In a world in which everyone were telling lies, you couldn't get away with lying, right? Other people would just anticipate that you are going to tell a lie, and because they anticipate that you're going to tell a lie, there is no advantage to lying. And so, again, in a world in which everyone is just telling lies, no one could get away with lying because it's just sort of expected that that's what people do, right? So again, there's no advantage to telling lies. So what Kant thinks is essentially going on is, I'm imagining a situation in which I want everyone else to keep the rules. That is to say, whenever I tell a lie, and I hope to gain from telling a lie, I'm imagining a situation where everyone abides by the rules while I take advantage of breaking them. Right? And another way to think about this is just to think about a game of chess, right? If you and I are playing a game of chess, and I'm cheating, the only way to gain by cheating is for you to continue to keep the rules while I break them. If you're also cheating and I'm cheating, the game just sort of disintegrates, right? But you know, if I'm going to take advantage of cheating, I've got to make it appear that, you know, that I'm on the up and up. All right. So what does that mean? Well, let me try to help you understand. I feel like I'm not explaining this very well. Let me try to help you understand with one final example. A couple years ago, I was driving home from North Carolina back up to Connecticut. I used to live in Connecticut, but I was visiting some family in North Carolina, and driving home after Thanksgiving weekend, and making my way up the New Jersey Turnpike back up to Connecticut. And of course, on your way from North Carolina to Connecticut, you're going to go through some major hubs, right? Like Washington, D.C., and then Philadelphia, New York City, on your way up back up to Connecticut. So you're on, you know, the I-95 corridor, lots of big cities, millions of people, right? And of course, Thanksgiving weekend. So it's no fun going back up that way. So here I am driving, and it's bumper-to-bumper traffic, and we're at a dead stop. And what I notice is that people begin to drive in the shoulder, trying to get around, and then finally, people were actually driving in the grass. I've never seen this anywhere else but on the New Jersey Turnpike. So people start to drive in the median, trying to get around traffic. Now, if Kant had been with me, he would have said that this was a violation of the formula of universal law, right? It's a form of cheating. And how is it made possible? Well, just like lying was only made possible in a world where, generally speaking, everyone tells the truth, driving in the median and in the shoulder is only possible in a world where, generally speaking, the rest of us drivers stay in the driving lanes, right? In other words, if everyone were to drive in the grass and on the shoulder, that would no longer be a viable option, right? And in the same way, if everyone were telling lies, lying would not make any sense because everyone would just simply anticipate that you're going to lie. So this is something like what Kant has in mind, right? Whenever I try to make myself an exception, I am helping myself, right, to a situation in which I expect you to obey the rules while I take advantage of breaking them. And Kant always says that this is a form of immorality. Right? Whenever I find myself wanting you to keep the rules while I take advantage of breaking them, I'm probably doing something immoral. Okay, so that's what he has in mind. I think we'll stop here. I've given you enough information, and I know that these Kant lectures are going to be a little bit more complex than the lectures that we had on utilitarianism, but that's just because Kant is a slightly more theoretically complex individual, right? So his moral philosophy is far more complex than Mill's was. Not that it's any better necessarily, right? Utilitarians continue to debate Kantians on you know the value of their varying perspectives. But I think anyone would admit that Kant is at least more theoretically abstract and difficult to comprehend. So I think I've given you enough today to think about, and we'll return and we'll start from here next time. All right.